Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
Vasudevaya.
Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 12, Chapter 9, Markandeya Rishi Sees the Illusory Potency. We are doing text 10 through 19. A lot of verses with no purports. Okay, we'll start doing text 10 responsively. Taishyaikada Bragushreshta Pushpabhadra Tate Mune Upasinasya Sandhyayam Brahman Vayur Abhun Mahan Taishyaikada Bragushreshta Pushpabhadra Tate Mune Upasinasya Sandhyayam Brahman Vayur Abhun Mahan Tashyaikada Bragushreshta Pushpabhadra Tate Mune Upasinasya Sandhyayam Brahman Vayur Abhun Mahan Tasya, while he, Ekada, one day, Bhrigu Shrestha, O best of the descendants of Bhrigu, Pushpabhadra Tate, on the bank of the river Pushpabhadra, Mune, the sage, Upasinasya, was performing worship. Sandhyayam, at the juncture of the day. Brahman, O Brahmana. Vayu, a wind. Abhut, arose. Mahan, great. Translation by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. O Brahman Shonaka, best of the Bhrigus, one day while Markandeya was performing his evening worship on the bank of the Pushpabhadra, a great wind suddenly arose. Because there's a lot of verses and difficult Sanskrit, I'm just going to read through the English the next few verses, starting with text 11. That wind created a terrible sound and brought in its wake fearsome clouds that were accompanied by lightning and roaring thunder. And it poured down on all sides torrents of rain, as heavy as wagon wheels. Then the four great oceans appeared on all sides, swallowing up the surface of the earth with their wind-tossed waves. In these oceans were terrible sea monsters, fearful whirlpools, and ominous rumblings. The sage saw all the inhabitants of the universe, including himself, tormented within and without by the harsh winds, the bolts of lightning, and the great waves rising beyond the sky. As the whole earth flooded, he grew perplexed and fearful. Report. Here the word chaturvidham refers to the four sources of birth for conditioned souls: embryos, eggs, seeds, and perspiration. 14. Even as Markandeya looked on, the rain pouring down from the clouds filled the ocean more and more until that great sea, its waters violently whipped into terrifying waves of hurricanes, covered up all the earth's islands, mountains, and continents. The water inundated the earth, outer space, heaven, and the celestial region. Indeed, the entire expanse of the universe was flooded in all directions, and out of all of its inhabitants, only Markandeya remained. His matted hair scattered, the great sage wandered about alone in the water, as if dumb and blind. Tormented by hunger and thirst, attacked by monstrous makaras and timangila fish, and battered by the winds and waves, he moved aimlessly through the infinite darkness into which he had fallen. As he grew increasingly exhausted, he lost all sense of direction and could not tell the sky from the earth. At times he was engulfed by a great whirlpool, sometimes he was beaten by the mighty waves, and other times the aquatic monsters threatened to devour him as they attacked one another. Sometimes he felt lamentation, bewilderment, misery, happiness, or fear. And at other times he experienced such terrible illness and pain that he felt himself dying. Countless millions of years passed as Markandeya wandered about in that deluge, his mind bewildered by the illusory energy of Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Om Agyana Pirandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksurunmikamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakopa Trivishya Kripa Sindhu Devacha Patidano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. In the previous verses, Markandeya Rishi asked the Lord to show him the illusory energy. And it reminded me of there's an English expression, I'm not sure the origin of it, but it's something like, you know, beware of that which most earnestly desires, because that one will surely receive. So we have to be very careful what we ask for. So Markandeya Rishi wanted to see the illusory potency of the Lord, and I guess Krishna showed him in all of its full force, particularly experiencing the annihilation as it would be at the end of the day of Brahma. I'm not sure whether this was the actual destruction at the end of Brahma, because that's what it appears to be, but it also says it was a display, and later it was like an illusion created. So whether it actually happened, you know, or whether it was an illusion of it, it's basically this is what happens during the annihilation of the universe. And Markandeya Rishi not only saw it, but experienced it all in a very vivid and kind of a very terrifying way. Now, I won't get into it, because as the verses continue, we'll see there is a happy ending here that Markandeya Rishi does get out of this. He sees Krishna, surrenders to Krishna, and you know, perhaps not so anxious to see the illusory energy in the future after that. But what do we take away from this? There's no purport, so I'm trying to figure, you know, what is your understanding? Material energy is very, very powerful. And the material energy is not just creation and maintenance, but it's also destruction. Often we think about the material energy in terms of its illusory appeal, its attraction. We become attracted to the material world. But the other side of that is the destruction, annihilation. And that's equally as powerful and equally a part of what is the material energy and how it manifests. In Bhagavad Gita 9.8, Krishna says, "The whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again, and under my will, it's annihilated in the end." And then in 18, he says, "I am the creation annihilation, the basis of everything, the resting place, the eternal seed." So in the Bhagavad Gita, the words are prabhava pralaya. Prabhava means creation, pralaya, dissolution. So this is the nature of the material world, creation and dissolution. It comes for some time, and then it's all destroyed. Sometimes it's manifest, Sometimes it's not manifest. But the material energy, Prakriti itself, is considered eternal. It's an eternal principle because it's always there, although its shape or form will change. It'll manifest or unmanifest. Srimad Bhagavatam 3.10.13 says, this cosmic manifestation is as it is now, was the same in the past, and will continue in the same way in the future. Prabhupada explains in the purport, there's a systematic schedule for the perpetual manifestation, maintenance, and annihilation of the material world. It's created now, it'll be destroyed later on, and so it also exists in the past, and again will be created, maintained, and destroyed in due course of time. Therefore, the systematic activities of the time factor are perpetual and eternal, and cannot be stated to be false. So sometimes, of course, the Mayavadis will say, this is all an illusion, this is all false. It is certainly temporary, it is not the absolute, but it is very real. This destruction, this annihilation, this creation of the material is very real, and we experience it as very real. Actually, I was thinking about, since our verses today are all about annihilation, earlier, a few chapters ago, in chapter 4, it was described that there are four types of annihilation, and those were all gone through in that chapter. It's really rather interesting. I hadn't heard that before reading that this chapter. And it described the four types of annihilation is first nitya, which is continuous, which means the destruction of the body. One of the annihilations is when we experience lifetime after lifetime. The body stays for some time, and then it's annihilated. The next one is namitika, the occasional destruction, which comes about after each day of Brahma. And I think that's what we're seeing here. This is a description. In Markandeya Rishi, it's been experienced as namitika annihilation. Then there's prakritika, which is elemental, which is the final annihilation after the lifetime of Brahma. At the end of all of these days, 100 years of his life, 365 days times 100, at that time, there's the total annihilation. And then finally, they mention anyantika, which is called final or liberation. Now, that was interesting, I thought, because one of the annihilations was liberation, because it's the destruction of the false ego. So the destruction of the false ego is what brings about liberation from material energy and from the material world and material concept of life. So this creation, destruction that's going on, this disillusion, these are all examples of what we call the dualities of material energy. Bhagavad Gita 7.27 says, Osiyana Bharata, all living entities are born into delusion, bewildered by dualities arising from desire and hate. So, of course, desire and hate are also dualities. These dualities that we have of wanting things, in other words, desire and hate are two opposites. We're attracted, we're repulsed. We want something, we don't want something else. We seek one thing, or we try to avoid another. Particularly, we try to seek pleasure, avoid pain. All of these dualities, though, bewilder the living entity, and therefore they're in delusion. Now, it's not just that we're in some delusion. We're not understanding the material nature. We're not understanding our real spiritual position. But because of that, we also suffer due to this duality. The duality of the material world causes or brings about that suffering. It doesn't actually cause it exactly, but because of duality, we experience suffering. 15.7 says, the living entities in the conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. Due to conditional life, they're struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. So it's Prakriti Stani Karshati. We are struggling very hard in material existence. Born into this world, born into a duality, the result is struggling, particularly with the senses and the mind. Because the material world looks very attractive. It engages the senses, it engages the mind, it attracts them. But in the end, what does it do for us? Well, we can see with Markandeya Rishi, it didn't turn out too well. It's very, very destructive. Now, not only destructive to the entire universe, in this case, of the annihilation, but destructive in our own lives. Because we are falsely identifying with the pain and the pleasure of this body and senses. So we tend to, of course, because we identify with this body through false ego, we act on those desires of the body, sense, mind, and intelligence. And sometimes those actions lead us in bad places, lead us in the wrong direction. And due to those activities, many of them sinful activities, based upon trying to avoid pain, experience pleasure in this material world, what happens is an ever-increasing implication in the karmic reactions in this material world. So experiencing, of course, birth and death through many lifetimes, and those lifetimes based upon the activities that we are doing. Those activities are based upon the desires, the mind, and the senses. So this is a very difficult situation a living entity is put into. The Bhagavatam 8.5.30 says, no one can overcome the Supreme Personality of Godhead's illusory energy, Maya, which is so strong that it bewilders everyone, making one lose the sense to understand the aim of life. I always thought this was an interesting verse, I know I've quoted it before, because not only do we not understand the aim of life, we become bewildered, but we even lose the sense to understand the aim of life. In other words, we don't even know that that's what we should be doing. I mean, it's one thing saying, I want to know what is the meaning of life and I'm having trouble finding it, but the living entity is so bewildered, they don't even know to try to find out the meaning of life. They just go about, you know, their business, lifetime after lifetime, enjoying or suffering this material world. And only a few rare souls think, what is the meaning? What is the purpose? So these few rare souls we find here in the Bhagavatam class, those of you who have asked those questions, and some of you were fortunate enough to become devotees of Krishna, get those answers. But generally, that's not the situation. This ever-increasing implication in material life, losing the sense of even knowing what to ask, what not to ask. Wasn't that when Lord Chaitanya first spoke to Sanatana Goswami? Didn't he say that? He said, people think that I'm a learned man, but I don't even know who I am, right? I don't even know the most fundamental thing of life. Of course, Sanatana Goswami is speaking for the conditioned soul. So we try to enjoy this material world. In the purport to that verse, Srila Prabhupada says, the external energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead gives us all conditioned souls what appears to be an opportunity to be happy within this material world. That is Maya. In other words, it is a dream never to be fulfilled. So that's what this pure life is. It's a dream that's never fulfilled. You know, I think you used to call it change up or something. You know, it's like you're offered something and then it's taken away, or you think you've got a good deal, but then it doesn't turn out not to really be that way. You know, like every piece of junk mail you receive, right? How it's some wonderful thing, or that, you know, you've just won $10 million. And yeah, so that's what it's like. It's like a scam. It's like these mail scams or these internet scams. You know, hey, this really looks good. Try it out. And it turns out to be something very different. And why? Because we cannot really enjoy this material world, at least not for very long. We can maybe for a little while, because it's not our rightful place. It's not our place of happiness. It's not our Sanatana Dharma. It's not our Sarup to be in these material bodies. And therefore, suffering is always going to be there in this material world. So, naturally, the question rises, how do we become free from this duality? How do we avoid the duality of birth and death, destruction, creation, annihilation, all of these things? Well, the Bhagavad Gita, 2:45, says, be free from all dualities and all anxieties for gain and safety and be established in the self. Simple enough, just be established in the self. Let's all go out and do that. That requires a little more explanation, of course. What does it mean to be established in the self? How do we do that? What is the self? Well, one thing that we have to understand is what is the opposite of being established in the self? In other words, the self is the real identity, the Atma, the soul, of course, in relationship with Krishna. So if we're not established in the self, we're established in false ego, false identification with the body, because self is the real identity, real ego, And, of course, the opposite of that is false ego. So, back in when we were in the 11th canto, chapter 23, there was a long description of the false ego. Very interesting descriptions there. And it's described there again that the ahankara, or the false ego, gives shape to material existence. It's called aham samshriti rupina. The shape, or the rupina, the form of material existence is created by false ego. So Vishnu Chakravarti, of course, says the quality of ahankara, false ego, is to define our bondage in samsara. So it defines it. In other words, due to our specific desires, material energy provides a specific body. You know? So the ego means identity, and ahankara firmly establishes that identity with matter. It accepts gross and subtle bodies and its concomitant suffering. So sometimes it's described that the desire of the living entity are the actual cause of creation. Why does this material world come into existence? Due to the desires of living entity. Without those, there'd be no need for the material world. So it's also described in verse 55 to 23 as the false ego identification matter established in the consciousness of the jiva is the cause of material existence. Okay? So, false ego is established. Suffering is experienced due to false ego. It's also, where do we experience suffering? We don't exactly experience suffering in the false ego, do we? When you think about it, false ego is an identification. We experience suffering in our mind, primarily, right? The mind is the source of suffering. And Vishnu says that the mind is the largest part of the subtle body. The subtle body being mind, intelligence, ego, mind tends to predominate the subtle body, you know, especially for the conditioned soul. So, but of course, mind is a material element. It is different than the jiva or the atma, although we strongly identify with it. But the ahankara, the false ego, creates the strong identification with the body and the mind, and so we identify with these mental processes and desires. The function of the mind is thinking, feeling, and willing, it's described. So that is what we are doing. We have all of these thoughts, we have all of these feelings, and they lead to desiring how to fulfill these things. So caught in that, it's very difficult to get out of this material world, very difficult to overcome Maya. And we see that all living entities are completely entrapped here. However, Krishna does give us an assurance that it can be done. It says, Daivi Hesha Gunamaya, Mama Mayati Duryatiya, Mami Vaye Prabhupadyante, Mayam Etam Tarantite. The divine energy of mind, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is very difficult to overcome. But those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. So, it all comes down once again to the surrendering process. This material world cannot be overcome. The material energy cannot be defeated by our own personal endeavors. But through the help of Krishna, and of course the Guru, one is able to do this. Krishna says, those who have surrendered can easily cross beyond it. So, the surrendering process, what does it mean? Actually, only a couple of verses earlier, in the class the other day, we heard how Markandeya was surrendering to Krishna through remembering and meditating on him. It was described in verse 9, just a couple of verses ago, that it said he was meditating constantly upon the Lord within the fire, the sun, the moon, the water, the earth, air, lightning, and his own heart, and worshiping him with paraphernalia conceived in his mind. So Markandeya was constantly remembering Krishna, thinking of Krishna, not just in some very abstract way, but actually identifying with all of the elements, even all the material elements. In other words, wherever he looked, wherever he saw, whether it was the sun, the moon, he would see Krishna. And that's one of the visions, or one of the ways of seeing and perceiving that devotees need to develop. We all need to develop that. And because it's very easy just to walk out the door and just see the material energy and just kind of like, here it is, I'm in the material energy. But we can consciously, and of course the Bhagavad Gita describes these things. You see, you know, the moon and the sun are, you know, all identified with Krishna, Krishna's eyes. You know, we can see in so many ways, I'm the taste of water. In other words, everything that is there, everything that we see, the devotee learns to see in relationship with Krishna. I'm just reading in the Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami, the other day, that he describes the different processes of bhakti, and mostly describes pure devotional service, but he also describes karma mishra bhakti, or mixed devotional service. And he says, but the devotee who is not yet perfect, who is, you know, basically has material desire, must do is somehow offer everything to Krishna, even those material desires. And he gave the example that one who, one verse is, just as a young man's, a young boy's attraction is to a young girl, in the same way, let my mind become attracted to Krishna. So in other words, one needs to basically change or shift the attraction from the material energy to attraction to Krishna. You know? So somehow or another, we need to learn to remember Krishna in all things and to use everything in this world for the service of Krishna. In the Bhakti Saramita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami, before he gives all the rules and regulations of Vaidhi Bhakti, he says, you must remember the principal rule, which is always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. I think it's from the Padma Purana, maybe. One of those. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. So, it's difficult for us to always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna, especially at the early stages of bhakti as neophytes. It's very difficult. We are in the process of sadhana bhakti, specifically Vaidhi bhakti, and this is very, very important because it is difficult to remember Krishna, but through the processes of sadhana, of bhakti yoga, we're able to begin to remember Krishna. First we know Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. We begin by hearing and chanting and service, and then that allows us to remember Krishna more and more. So we need to conduct our lives in such a way that help us to remember Krishna. In other words, we need to give ourselves the opportunities to take the purifying force of bhakti, of devotional service, to be able to purify our hearts and help us to more and more remember Krishna. In a purport to 4.22.24 Bhagavatam, Prabhupada talks about this remembrance. He says, smritya means remembering Krishna always. Life should be molded in such a way that we cannot remain alone without thinking of Krishna. We should live in Krishna so that while eating, sleeping, walking, working, we remain only in Krishna. Our Krishna consciousness and society recommends that we arrange our living so that we can remember Krishna. And of course, that's what Srila Prabhupada did. He established a society, established a practice. And of course, the practice of sadhana is completely based upon the five principles of Rupa Goswami, obviously. So we're hearing the Bhagavatam, we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're worshiping the deities, associating with the devotees, and living in these holy places. So this is the practice of bhakti. These five principles, of course, are most prominent of all the 64 principles given by Rupa Goswami, and they're all based on the principle that through this association, we are able to more and more give up our attraction to material world and become attracted to Krishna and remember Krishna. But in the Bhakti Saramita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami mentions there's also some qualification. There's some qualification for bhakti. Obviously, not everybody takes it up. And even those who try to take it up, it can be difficult. And some people leave the practice of bhakti yoga. So he says, the qualification is first that one has developed some faith. And we know that shraddha, adao. But we know that faith is most important in the beginning. And where does that faith come from? He says, it's received from prior association with devotees. So sometimes we say there, you know, we say that there's faith, shraddha, and then sadhusanga. association of devotees, but in one sense it also works the other way. Through association of devotees, one develops faith. There's given faith. You know, because what faith did we have on our own? Many of us, if we were not fortunate enough to grow up in a Vaishnava family, or we were here in America, we didn't know who Krishna was. We had absolutely no concept of this philosophy. None. Some of us, I mean, I read a Bhagavad Gita before Prabhupada's, and I say I understood about zero, practically nothing. I didn't know what it meant. It sounded nice. What did it mean? We can't understand these things. But with association of the devotee, when we associate with Srila Prabhupada, and we heard from him, and we read Srila Prabhupada's purports, it started to become clear. And then faith developed. I remember my strongest impression of seeing Srila Prabhupada in 1972 in New Vrindavan was, and I wasn't really a devotee then, I hadn't joined the temple, but you know, it's a long story, but somehow or another I got to New Vrindavan and Srila Prabhupada was there. And the strongest impression was that, for me, was whether I understand all of this philosophy or not, this person does. This person understands it, this person is living it, this person is the pure representative of God. And therefore, I have faith. I had faith to follow, I had faith to accept. Yeah. And that's, Prabhupada says faith is, what he says is, unflinching belief in something sublime. So, something that might be a little beyond our normal experience, something that is subtle. Something that's not so easily grasped, and much of this philosophy is not so easily grasped. You know, it's like, do we understand all of these things about, you know, the annihilation of the universe? Yeah. Tim and Gila fish swimming through, I mean, no, it's, but it's like, do we have faith in this? Yeah. Yes. We have faith in this. This is the words of Krishna, and this is given to us by the Acharyas, the great sages. People who are so advanced in spiritual knowledge we can barely imagine. And most importantly, given to us by Srila Prabhupada, the living example, the person Bhagavad, the living example. So we have faith in all of these things. And if we don't fully understand, it's very simple. I don't understand yet. And as I continue to serve and continue to hear, hopefully I'll understand more. I think it's not really a difficult, confusing process. It's pretty straightforward. At least it should be. Okay, some of you may disagree. But anyway, I've always had a very simple approach, and I think it kind of works, you know, not to worry too much about what you don't understand or what seems very complicated, because in time you do. And all of us who have been around for a few years experience that. You know, we experience that we understand more and more, our realization becomes deeper, our faith becomes stronger as we progress in Krishna consciousness. But it doesn't happen unless we are performing the basics, unless we're chanting Hare Krishna, unless we're associating with devotees, unless we're hearing the philosophy. Prabhupada wanted us to hear this philosophy every day, to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam class. Here at Bhagavad Gita class, well, we don't do that so much anymore, but at least hopefully we continue to read on our own if there's not an evening class. These things are very important. It's because there, you know, there has to be faith, there has to be association with devotees. Rupa Goswami also explains that one shouldn't be too attached to material objects, nor too detached. In other words, not being too detached, meaning not falsely detached. False renunciation, which we see, we've all seen that, devotees who are overly renounced, falsely, when maybe they're very new devotees, usually it doesn't last. In fact, it may cause more trouble for them. So one needs to be honest about one's level of advancement, and of course, following the principles, one needs to, you know, perform according to his level of adhikari. So, and it's also described that false renunciation is not necessarily favorable to Krishna consciousness. Jiva Goswami says that too much vairagya causes the heart to become hard. So we don't want to falsely practice vairagya, so that our heart becomes hard and we don't can't experience relationships with devotees and the natural love that is there in Krishna consciousness. But there needs to be some preliminary detachment to material things, not false renunciation, not too much vairagya. It's also described there needs to be some detachment, and that's why we have the four regular principles, right? In other words, there needs to be some detachment from the most gross connection with the material energy. If we're just totally absorbed in that, we can't understand spiritual life. This philosophy won't really act. So we have the do's and the don'ts, as Prabhupada said. You know, and the principles are put us in the mode of goodness. They give us a platform by which we can understand spiritual life. Then the real process, of course, is the hearing and chanting and the association with devotees. So we need to have this mood of faith, take association with devotees, perform our daily sadhana. Then we'll be able to remember Krishna. When we remember Krishna, we are no longer in false ego. We are no longer identifying with the false identity that I am the doer, I am the enjoyer, I am the Lord and the Master of all that I see. Everything that we think and do in this material world, we can overcome that. So hopefully we won't have to go through an experience quite as extreme as Markandeya Rishi and get, you know, thrown into the cosmic devastation as a, that'd be quite a wake-up call, wouldn't it? That this material world is really, really a difficult place. But in a sense, we're all experiencing that. Like we're all experiencing at the end of every lifetime this, you know, sort of partial, what did it call? Was it Nitya? That partial annihilation, that Nitya, continuous destruction of the body. We've experienced that how many times? Life after life after life. And we didn't, you know, and it takes a while to sink in. We haven't immediately understood that this is not our place of enjoyment. This will not bring us happiness. So hopefully through the process of hearing the Bhagavatam, hearing these pastimes, these experiences from these great devotees, we learn more and more. Then as our faith develops, our hearing and chanting develops, more and more the false ego drops away. It's described that the subtle body is dissolved, right? By the process of devotional service. But that's interesting. Probably says dissolved. In other words, it goes away. We don't have to do something artificial. Just the process of bhakti will accomplish that. Okay? I think I'll stop at this point. Any questions or comments? Maharaj, could you add something? Have a microphone? This one.
According to Maitreya Rishi, there is some description about his life. When he appeared, he was son of one saintly person, Mirkanda, and he as soon as took birth, Markandeya Rishi. Astrologer, they predicted that he has life has spent only for 12 or 16 years, he will die. So parents and they become very much concerned. Almost time for death was very near, so they sent the boy to go worship. There is one place here, verse was Pushpa Bhadra River. On the river bank, Pushpadra River, there is one deity still there in Kerala. Nava Mukundan, Mukunda, Krishna, deity. So he went in temple and always praying, please Lord save me. And that time Yamaraj personally came to take his life. And then he became very much scared. So he ran away from there. Though he was in temple, but Yamaraj was coming, sir. So he went to another place, there was very near, approximate 5-6 miles away, there another temple, Shiva temple, Shivalinga. I grabbed the Shivalinga. And then Jamraj was chasing, following, and then he threw his rope. He wanted to throw the ring part, the rope on his neck, and he wanted to drag. By the time he was stuck completely with the Shivalinga. So that rope also surrounded the Shivalinga also. And he was trying to pull, and immediately Shiva appeared. And Shiva chased him, Jamraj. And thus he gave benediction that he had a long life. So that reason why Markandeya Rishi, though he was destined to die at the age of, I don't remember, 12 or 16, so still he is there. 7 manvantara he survived. This is 7 manvantara is going on by Vasat Manvantara. So thus he got extraordinary. Yeah,
that's probably what, about 2 billion years or something?
Eh?
About 2 billion years, is it?
Billions
of years. Thank you. Anyone else? Badanahan?
When you quoted that faith and you started to give the explanation of it, I thought I remembered it too, so I looked it up, and it's from 241 Bhagavad Gita, which is the verses, "For those who are on this path are resolute in purpose, their aim is one. O beloved child of the Kurus, the intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched." And then Prabhupada gives this wonderful definition two times. The first one is a strong faith that Krishna consciousness, by Krishna consciousness, one will be elevated to the highest perfection of life. That's called Vyasikatmika Pudhi. And then Prabhupada, the next, he quotes from Majjhalita 2262, but I'm just going to read after that. It says, "Faith means unflinching trust in something sublime."
Unflinching trust in something sublime.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's from Majjhalita.
Well, Prabhupada's quoting this in 241 Bhagavad Gita.
Okay.
And then when you mentioned about bhakti dissolves the subtle body, I always liked that one. So I read it a couple times in 325, 33. Lord Kapila talking to his mother, the glories of devotional service. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he mentions that it actually digests it. That's how it dissolves it.
And, I read that, yeah.
And then when he says, when you digest food, the action separates it into nourishment and waste. So he says, so when you renounce things, accept those things favorable, renounce those things unfavorable, that's the process, that's the enzyme, so to speak. So when you accept those things favorable, that builds your spiritual body, and you reject those things unfavorable, that surrendering process is what turns your, dissolves the false ego, like rejecting those things unfavorable for the devotional service.
Thank you. I know you're good on verses and numbers. Do you happen to remember where that one is described?
That verse is
Vishnu's.
Yeah, it's 325:33.
Okay. Yeah, that's the chapter on devotional service.
Yeah, the glories of devotional
325,
service.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Would you say that Markandeya Rishi regretted this desire to experience all his illusion? I mean, you think,
Well, there must have been some times he did, because it describes all these emotions. He was experiencing fear and things like that, but it worked out in the end.
And especially in the night of Brahma, when he is in the ocean of devastation and being attacked by all those. And the night of Brahma is the same as the day of Brahma. That is over 4 billion years.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. Wasn't it in the previous verse where it said Krishna smiled ruefully or something? In other words, like, he wasn't real happy with his question. But you know, he understood Markandeya Rishi was a pure devotee, and he wanted to know about his energy. But then there's something about Krishna was a little.
Right.
So I guess this is what he. Yeah, okay, you want to see it? He showed it to him. Yeah. Dharmaraj.
You know, you were talking about faith, and so I was thinking that even if you put aside our Krishna conscious philosophy and everything else, as if you go and talk to someone out there, tell them, well, you know, just have faith, it's probably not going to go down too well. But if you look around from a very logical point of view, is that any sphere of life, anything you do, you know, that initial faith has to be there. You know, faith, whether you're trying to be the biggest materialist or whatever the case may be, we have to have faith in the words of the scientists.
Everyone has faith.
Of all these
right?
books or whatever, you know, the government, the leader, if, you know, even though we may never see him in this lifetime or whatever the case may be. So that, you know, faith has to be there. So sometimes, like, I would say, well, okay, why don't you try this? You have seen millions of people experiment with their faith in material life, and you see the result. Why don't you try it here? Experiment and, you know, do the practice like what Tamal Krishna Maharaj told his people in Fiji, that, okay, now why don't you try this and, you know, try this chanting and regulative principles for 8 months, and if you don't get peace, love, tranquility, and you don't feel different, then I'll personally write you a check for $10,000.
That's your offer.
Yeah. So,
if you ever, you never lost that battle, man.
So, you know, even from a logical point of view, is that we have to place our faith somewhere. So,
yeah, that's an important point. And Prabhupada's made a point a few places I can think of. I can remember that, you know, we all repose our faith somewhere. In other words, even the materialist has to have a certain amount of faith. You know, when you get in a car and you drive down the road, you have faith that most of the people are going to stay on the right side, at least in America, stay on the right side of the road, right? I mean, you know, you have faith that the sun will come up in the morning, and, you know, in other words, we couldn't even survive, we couldn't exist without some faith that things will happen in a certain way. Yeah, So faith is there. Faith is normal. So it's where do you repose your faith? And what will be the results of the different faith? Yeah. Okay. We got
it. Thinking, feeling, and willing. And I thought, you know, before the thinking is, or our thinking is based on what we're hearing or reading. And you mentioned how important it is to hear the philosophy. I just thought I'd mention that in reading this story from book distribution in New Zealand, Jay Shetty was brought up. He actually is a devotee who is in the Brahmachari Ashram in England, and he's an inspirational speaker, and he incredibly a big, big following. For any parents who are challenged, especially this summer while kids are out of school, to keep their kids in some positive screen time, I would highly recommend them to look up Jay Shetty, Jay Shetty. And he speaks basically from the Bhagavad Gita. It very, very impressive. Any of you can look it up and see. Yeah.
Isn't that thank you.
Amazing.
Okay, thank you so much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.